So I'm very happy to welcome Laura Garcia Alvarez, who's going to be talking about efficient simulability of CV states. So Laura did her PhD at the University of the Basque Country, and now she's a postdoc at the Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden. And she's interested in CV quantum computation and also variational quantum algorithms. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for the nice introduction, and thank you for inviting me. I feel really honored to be presenting this work. Wait. First of all, I would like to give credit to the co-authors of this paper. So this was done together with Cameron Calcluth, Giulia Ferrini, and Alessandro Ferraro. Cameron is a PhD student here at Chalmers. And Julia is in this Zoom meeting, was leading the project. The three of us are financed by the Wallenberg Center for Quantum Technology here, which is a large project for building a quantum computer, basically, both with CV and DV quantum computation approaches. And Alessandro Ferraro is in the UK at Queen's University, Belfast. So I would like to first of all thank them for the fruitful collaboration and for the really nice discussions. The outline that I'm going to follow is the outline of the paper because I think that's going to be easier for everyone. So I will introduce the basic concepts and immediately after the main results, and without giving many explanations about them. And then later on, I will go through the sections of the paper. From three to five, I will go very fast because this is just reviewing concepts and theorems that are already well known for these discrete variable systems. To then, from six to eight, introduce most of the work that we develop, basically. So six, I'm going to review bosonic codes. To encode qubits and qubits in continuous variables. And then basically, the main part of our job was to interpret logical qubits encoded with bosonic codes as logical qubits. So I will be spending more time here. And then once that is done, the result will be immediate, the result of the paper, which is assessing for what kind of input states we can, what kind of continuous variable architectures are efficiently simulable. And finally, I will summarize the results, and I would also talk a bit about the limitations of this work and the future lines that we are following right now to overcome that limitations. Okay, so the introduction. This work is framed in the context of resources for continuous variable quantum computation. So, in particular, we focus on the Wigner negativity. Basically, we look at the Wigner function, which is defined, as you see, for a density matrix, a quantum state. And then we consider that the Wigner function is negative if it is negative in some region of the phase space. So basically, one way of quantifying that could be with the Wigner logarithmic negativity. So if you look at this formula, if the Wigner function is positive everywhere in the phase space, we can forget about this absolute value. And then the integral of the Wigner function in the whole phase space would be one if it is properly normalized. And then the logarithm would be zero. Whereas if it is negative in some region of the phase space, this integral would be larger than one, and then we would have some negativity. So when I say Wigner negative element, I'm referring to that, to the fact that the Wigner function is negative in some region. And this can be done not only for quantum states, but also can be analyzed also for operations and measurements. So just a reminder, as an example, pure Gaussian states are Wigner positive. For example, a coherent state has a Wigner function which is positive. and Gaussian, the same for squid states, but a single photon state would be Wigner negative in this case, for example. So why we look at the Wigner negativity is because in continuous variables, there are theorems that link the Wigner negativity with quantum advantage, or better said, the opposite. Wigner positivity cannot yield to quantum advantage. That is, if a continuous variable architecture has is described by Wigner positive functions, there is no quantum advantage. And the architecture consists of input states, some gates, and measurements in the end. So what we can conclude from that novel theorem is that the Wigner negativity is a necessary resource to implement non-trivial quantum computations. But is it sufficient would be the question, right? So also what can lead us to think that the Wigner negativity is a good resource for quantum advantage is that there are classical algorithms for continuous variables that whose running time scales exponentially with the Wigner logarithmic negativity. So that may lead us to think that the Wigner negativity is really a good resource to characterize quantum advantage. Also, boson sampling can be understood with this framework, with this resource. So for example, boson sampling with heterodyne detection, so here the Wigner negative elements would be the input states, yield hazards of sampling. The same for these kind of architectures where the input states are Gaussian, you will have some non-Gaussian evolution and then some homodyne measurement. This also yields hardness of sampling. And many, many different examples. For example, you see this Gaussian boson sampling, where in this case, the negativity comes in the measurements, in the on-off measurements. So, we were thinking in this context because Julia has worked with these kind of architectures. And then we wonder, what are the conditions for quantum advantage in continuous variables? Is the Wigner negativity a sufficient condition? Quickly, we answer that no, because we can think about a trivial counterexample. And that is the beginning of our work. So we thought, if we use bosonic codes, for example, take the Gottesman-Kitaev-Preskill encoding, that from now on I will refer as EKP, or any kind of rotationally symmetric bosonic codes like CAT codes or binomial codes. And we interpret now the continuous variable operations as logical operations with that states. What happens? So it happens that the Wigner negativity is not a sufficient condition because though we can create circuits that are Clifford. Take the counterexample with GKP encoding. So imagine a circuit where we input encoded Pauli eigenstates. Those by the encoding in the continuous variables will have a negative Wigner function because it is a train of deltas. Then we consider the encoded Clifford operations that have positive Wigner function because are these Gaussian operations. So all of these, well, the generators of the Clifford operations are Gaussian. And then finally, consider Pauli measurements, which would correspond to homodyne detection, which have a positive Wigner function. So this circuit has some negativity in the input, but yet if we consider the Gottesman-Neel theorem purely from discrete variables, it would be simulable. So the quick answer is no. And then we thought, can we extend this way of thinking to include more operations here? So basically our research question was, can we simulate the following circuit efficiently? So consider encoded Pauli eigenstates, for example, with GKP encoding, which have a negative Wigner function And then instead of just the three Gaussian operations that we saw before that generated the Clifford operations for this encoding, let's consider general Gaussian operations, which also have a positive beginner function. And then finally, the measurements, we leave them the same. So we consider Pauli measurements, which have a positive beginner function because they correspond to homoline detection. What happens with this circuit? So the general Gaussian operations are not logical qubit gates, because now they don't they include displacements where this S1, S2 are correspond to a continuous parameter. So if you recall in the GKP encoding, that would be just square root of pi. So not all displacements are logical gates. So now we would be moving out of the code space, and we cannot use the Gottesmanic theorem to assess these circuits. And from the purely continuous variable perspective, we had the previous Naugle theorem, the Mariaiser theorem, and we cannot assess if this is simulable or not, because it is not recognized by the theorem, because we have some negativity here. So the theorem said if everything is Wigner positive, then we can simulate it. If there is some negativity, we don't know. So in principle, encoded Pauli eigenstates plus general Gaussian operations are not accessible by the theorems. So what we concluded after what I'm going to present later is that we cannot answer to that question, but we can enlarge the operations that are simulable. And we do that by encoding the logical qubits into logical qudits, both of them defined in continuous variables, so that we can extend the families, the set of logical gates in continuous variables, because now we will be accessing not only the Clifford operations defined for qubits, but since we are interpreting these qubits as qudits, we can include more Gaussian operations than the ones that we have before. So we can identify families of circuits by exploiting this structure as the Clifford circuits. And once that we identify them as Clifford, then we can just borrow existing Naugle theorems of discrete variable quantum computation to say that this is simulable. So basically, we are finding structures in continuous variables to identify that as Clifford circuits in the logical sense, to then borrow theorems from discrete variables to say that this is simulable. So for translation symmetric codes, I mean GKP, this will translate to the following. So we say that the following circuit is simulable. We start with some encoded Pauli eigenstate of a qudit of dimension d1. So this j go from 0 to d1 minus 1. Then we can include Clifford operations associated not with this qudit, but with qudits of dimension d2 higher. So that means that we are including here in these displacements here more operations than the trivial ones that we would immediately guess for the qudit of dimension d1. And then the measurements, we leave them the same. They would be the homodyne measurements. So we are saying basically that these families of circuits with this kind of displacements, where alpha is not a continuous parameter, so that's why we say discrete families, is given by this expression, can be very small. So we would be able to include displacements that in principle even arbitrarily small, because A is a natural number that you can choose to be very large, for example. So that would be the first set of families that we identify as simulable. We have two results for rotation symmetric codes, because we have two ways of encoding qubits into qudits. So the result would be very similar to the previous one, But here, I'm considering Pauli eigenstates of dimension D1. I will explain later what is n and phi, but for the moment, you can think that is a logical state of a qubit of dimension D1 encoded with the RSB codes. And then in a similar way, I will include here not all Gaussian operations, but Clifford operations for logical Clifford operations for a qubit of a higher dimension D2. In a similar way, that allows us to have assimilable operations, more rotations here than the ones that we have trivially have, and more parameters here for the self-care interaction and the same for the cross-care interaction here. So also notice that in this case, these operations are not non-Gaussian. So in these circuits, we'll have negativity not only in the input, but also in the operations, in the gates. And finally, you can consider that the measurements are phase measurements, or as defined in the paper of RSB codes, these phase measurements can be effectively done with homodyne measurements in the end, but they also define mathematically what is the phase measurement. That's the second result. Since we have another way of encoding with RSB codes the qubits into qubits, we have another result, which is very similar, just change a bit here. These parameters in front of the self-care interaction and the cross-care interaction, and the same for the rotations. And here we can encode just the zero logical states, and we could access any dimension D2, whereas previously it was determined a bit what dimension we could access. And the measurements would be the same. So that would be the main message of the paper, basically. These kind of circuits with this structure can be assessed with the discrete variable theorems, because we have identified them as Clifford by encoding the qubit of dimension D1 into a qubit of dimension D2. So that's the main message. Let's go now very quickly to 3, 4, 5. So this is just a review of results, and then I will explain its translation to continuous variables. So just for completeness, we can define a qubit as a superposition of 0 and 1. The Pauli group of a single qubit is formed by this set of operators. The Pauli group for n qubits follows from the one for a single qubit. And then the Clifford group are the set of operations that map elements of the Pauli group to elements of the Pauli group via conjugation. And what we notice here is that we need to notice to assess our results is that this Clifford group is generated by the Hadamard, the phase, and the Sinod gates. This can be extended for qubits of any dimension. So a qubit is then a superposition of in the computational basis of j's from 0 to d minus 1. And then the Pauli group of a single qubit, you can define it analogously. There is a subtlety depending on if the dimension is odd or even, but basically it's possible to define the Pauli group. And then the same for the Pauli operators, and the same for the Clifford group, where here the generators of the Clifford group would be the Fourier, the phase gate, and the sum gate, which is the equivalent to the Sinod gate. So that would be the Fourier gate for qubits. That would be the phase gate that also this subtlety that I mentioned before, depending on if the dimension is even or odd, transpires here. So the phase gate would be different depending on if we are dealing with the even or odd dimensions. And the sum gate would be like the equivalent to the Sinod gate. written in this form. So this is just reviewing what exists for discrete variable systems. We are going to use the theorems of discrete variable systems. So basically, we are going to use the Gottesman-Neel theorem. Before that, I wanted to mention there is a way of mapping qubits into qubits in discrete variables, but it's not exactly the same mapping that we are going to use, but it's going to be useful for us. So a logical qubit can be encoded in a physical qubit in this way. So this, in the left-hand side, I will consider a logical qubit of dimension d1, the state j, can be expressed as the following superposition of states of a qubit of dimension d2, where d2 is related to d1 by this equation, where a1 and a2 are natural numbers. And the operators are encoded in this way, the logical operators. So in our work, we will use symmetric encodings, and we will need to add something else to this way of encoding in discrete variables. By symmetric encodings, I mean that A1 is equal to A2. So that allows that if that were not the case, then the Fourier or the Hadamard will change in D1 and D2. If they are equal, it will be the same operation. And the same for the for other operations that are not the X and Z. So we will use symmetric encodings. And for example, following this equation, the serological state of a qubit, these two refers to the qubit subspace, can be expressed as this superposition of the states of a qubit of dimension 8. So this was already known for discrete variables, this kind of structures on how to encode qubits into qubits. Notice also that if we were to interpret this right-hand side as a logical input state, it would be a stabilized state in dimension d2, meaning that if you supply a circuit with this kind of superpositions, and then you act with Clifford operations of defined for the qubit dit of dimension d2, you can simulate that efficiently. So later on, our encoding of qubits into qubits and the interpretation of the logical qubits, we can use that to say that the circuits will be Clifford in the end, because this is also stabilizer if we supply it to a circuit with operations of Clifford in dimension D2. Now I was jumping too fast. Now is when I'm going to review the theorem. So basically, we are going to use the Gottesman-Neel theorem and extensions of that theorem to then say that our logical Clifford circuits of systems of dimension D2 are simulable. So basically, it's going to be the Gottesman-Neel theorem and extensions of it. This theorem says that a circuit based only on qubits initialized in a Pauli eigenstate, Clifford group operations that are generated by the Hadamard, the phase, and the synod, and Pauli measurements can be simulated efficiently with a classical computer. We are not going to use exactly this theorem because this is for a qubit, but we might look at extensions to odd prime dimension D and extensions to any dimension, because with our encoding, we go to a dimension D2 that in principle is composite. So we need of these extensions of the Gottesman-Neel theorem to say that the Clifford circuits in a higher dimension are simulable. Now let's start with the continuous variable systems. So what I have said so far is only for discrete variables. But it is possible to define qubits and qubits in continuous variables through bosonic codes. So let's translate that to continuous variables to try to answer the question that we posed in the beginning. So bosonic codes are methods for storing quantum information in bosonic modes such that you can correct that after. It explodes some redundancy in the way you encode. So we distinguish between translation symmetric codes or GKP codes and rotation symmetric bosonic codes. And we have derived results for these two families. Rotation symmetric bosonic codes are CAT codes, binomial codes, and more families of codes. And the basic change now is that we are dealing with Hilbert spaces of infinite dimension. We are no longer in a qubit space, though we are encoding logically qubits in this continuous variable realm. Just to remind you that GKP codes are defined in the ideal case in this way. So a qubit, so this J can take values 0 or 1. By these two, I refer that I'm in a code space of dimension 2, are a sum of deltas, are given by a train of deltas, equally spaced by 2 square root of pi. And the qubits can be defined in a similar way. So for example, for the qubit case, the 0 logical and the 1 logical state are the same, but displaced by a square root of pi. And for qubits, you will find similar encodings where the deltas are spaced now differently, given by this alpha. The operations, the Clifford operations, these are not a universal set. Yes, the Clifford operations are Gaussian operations, but not all Gaussian operations, because otherwise we would have answered already to our question, are just the Fourier transform, this searing operation, but with this coefficient here, and this control set. This will form our group of Clifford operations. You can also look at the logical operators that are displacement, and immediately you can see, for example, if you apply this displacement to the 0 logical state, it will displace it by square root of pi, and then we will have the 1 state. So when we encode this qubit into qubits, you can now think that we are going to access smaller and smaller displacements because of the encoding itself, that the distance for qubits is smaller. So that's already part of the idea. Rotation symmetric codes are the code space is stabilized by this rotation operator. So if we apply this rotation operator to any state, logical state, it will return the state with eigenvalue plus 1. And a way of defining ideally these states is the following. We take a primitive function that in this case, it's going to be a coherent state. And then we apply rotations on it depending on the n-fold symmetry of the rotation symmetric code times some coefficient here. So for example, here we are going to encode the 1 logical state of a qubit with n-fold symmetry 4, n equal to 4, and a primitive function that is going to be a coherent state. Graphically, one can see it in this way. We have a coherent state here with the eigenvalue plus 1. Then we rotate by 45 degrees if you do the in the calculation here, times minus one. Then we rotate again the next summon by 45 degrees, coefficient plus one, and so on and so forth, until you get this graphical representation. This is a way of thinking about these rotation symmetric codes. Then one can define the logical operations that general framework was given here in this paper by Arne Grinsmo et al. And you can define the logical operator and see that, for example, the set operator will be just rotating, in this case, by pi over four radians. So if we rotate this state, this one state, by 45 degrees, we get the same structure, yes, the colors of these blobs will change. So applying the set to the one gives minus the one, as we should expect. And with the logical operators, it's easy to see how they act in a graphical way, the same as with the GKP. One can also, this we did, probably it exists in the literature, but we wanted to derive it with the same notation as they had in the previous paper by Arne. So what we did is to define qubits in this same way for RSB codes. So we derive this expression for the qubit states, and we derive also the logical operator. And we verified that applying this set given by this operation in the logical state gives you what it has to give you, like the root of the unity times, depending on the, which state of the qubit you have. And we did the same for the rest of operations. So we derive for a qubit what is the phase operation, which, as I said before, for discrete variables, it's going to be different if it is if we are dealing with an even or an odd dimension. We also define what is the control set operation for qubits. And this is just the definition of the Fourier transform, but I'm not going to enter into this, but in the paper we give a way of implementing it with a teleportation gate, just for the sake of completeness. But yeah, this is just the definition. How we derived it? It's not difficult to derive this if we consider the action of this operation in the logical encoded states expressed in the Fock basis. So I'm going back 1 second. If we change this expression, and instead of having a superposition in terms of this primitive function, we express it in as a superposition of Fock states, and then we apply the operation that we think is the logical operation, we can see if we can verify if it is or not. So it's not difficult to go to the Fock basis, because this n-fold rotational symmetry translate in a spacing in the Fock basis. So for example, if you have an m-fold symmetry in your stabilizer of the code space, that will mean that your states will be separated by m in the Fock basis. So you will have 0, m, and so on and so forth. So it's not difficult to go from one to the other. We do that in the paper, and then we derive these operations. Probably they exist in the literature in papers, but we wanted to derive it with the same notation as in that paper. And notice that unlike for the GKP, in this case, even these operations are Wigner negative, because they are not quadratic in Q and P, but they are quartic, because this number operator would be some Q squared plus P squared, right? So they are quartic. So they are Wigner negative. We will have even negativity in the operational side. And then the main part really that allows us to encode these qubits into qubits, or qubit of dimension D1 into qubit of dimension D2, we did by identifying the wave functions. So let's recall first how it is done in discrete variables. So in discrete variables, we had this formula. We are going to use A1 equal to A2. But there are some subtleties, especially in the case of RSB codes. So in the case of GKP, we are going to consider infinite energy, that is ideal GKP states, non-normalizable, this train of deltas. And in the case of rotationally symmetric bosonic codes, they are going to be ideal in the following sense. We are going to consider that the rotated primitives are orthogonal. So we have a primitive, we rotate it. The superposition with a primitive non-rotated is going to be zero. We are going to assume that. In general, that is not going to be the case, but in an ideal case where the blobs are very far away, so you have a highly energetic state, that's going to be approximately correct. So we are dealing with two ideal cases here to do the encoding. And as I said, we are going to identify the states comparing the wave functions. So for the GKP, we say that this is going to be the encoding, which is very similar to what we saw with discrete variables. The only thing that changes is that here we don't have this 1/√(a). And it's because we don't care about that coefficient, because we are dealing with non-normalizable states anyway. So what we see is that the train of deltas that corresponds to this logical J qubit state of dimension D1, if we write here the wave function, it will be the same wave function as that of this superposition of qubit states in dimension D2. It is best seen with an example. So for example, if we take on the left-hand side the zero logical state of a qubit, and we want to encode it, let's take A equal to 2. So we will go to the first dimension up that we go is 8. We want to encode it in a qubit of dimension 8. We can see almost visually now that the train of deltas of the zero logical state of a qubit correspond to the sum of the zero logical state of a qubit of dimension 8 plus the 4 logical state of a qubit of dimension 8. So, and we can do the identification for any dimension here. As I hinted before, immediately, if we interpret this qubit as a qubit, before we could only interpret as Clifford the displacements that move the 0 to 1, so that move by square root of pi. But now, since we have interpreted this as a qubit of dimension 8, we have this small displacement. The displacement that you see up to this line, for example, which is smaller than the previous that that we could trivially consider. And this is basically the idea, that going to a higher dimension, it allows you to interpret as logical more displacements that you had before.
Laura, can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
Just if we look, go back to that picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, could I just check that if you just look at, I understand that the operations will be different depending on Clifford's in the dimension you're working in, but if you look at the number of Clifford's that you have for 3 qubits, will that be a lot more than the number of Clifford's you would have on a single 8-dimensional system?
Here I'm thinking, I'm giving the example with a single mode, bosonic mode, but you need to think that this will include also the control set. So it will be the operations generated by this displacement on a single mode, plus whatever you generate with the control set. So it will include also multi-qubit operations, if that's if I understood.
I was more just saying, I guess, the number of Cliffords you have that act on eight-dimensional system, mm-hmm. How does that compare to the number of three-qubit Cliffords?
Yeah.
It's fewer, yeah? I think you get fewer operations, but maybe you get more displacements or something.
Yeah, but it's true. If you compare the Clifford operations of a single qubit, this is what you're saying, right? To three qubits, to the Clifford operations of three modes. Yeah, to me, it's difficult to compare. But also, I would argue that we are encoding in each mode, so on each line, the qubit into a qubit. So actually, we will have the Clifford operations for n qubits. So we will have the enlarged displacements of for each mode, then times, plus the control set and so on. So that wouldn't be the case for this. And then purely like if I just consider your question, probably you're right that, and probably a single mode would be simulable anyway if you don't add entanglement. But yeah, so probably there would be less Cliffords if you would have just one single qubit than n qubits. Yeah, that's...
Okay, thank you. That just helps me kind of just draw a better picture. Thank you for that.
Yeah. But as I said, here we would be encoding the qubit state in the input side on all the lines. So we will be comparing n qubits to n qubits. So we will be enlarging the set of operations. This is just the example with a single mode, kind of. For rotationally symmetric bosonic codes, we do, again, the same identification based on the wave functions. And here, there is a subtlety. So basically, we take the way of encoding in discrete variables. And in the beginning, we said, let's compare the qubit of dimension D1, this state, to the superposition. And in the beginning, we had written the same n-fold symmetry to both, and it didn't work out. And then we realized that we need also to find some conditions for the different symmetries of the of the different qubits to this wave function identification to work. And this is the first method that we find. So for example, I'm going to consider a qubit, a zero logical qubit with n equal to 4. So n fold symmetry equal to 4. And then let's use this formula. So I go again with a equal to 2. I go to dimension 8. So and it will be the 0 plus the 4. But now the m-fold symmetry of the second qubit will be 4 over 2, so 2. So this symmetry here is going to be 2. And then we see, just again graphically, that we can recreate this state by considering the zero logical state of a qubit of dimension 8 with n fold symmetry equal to 2 plus the 4. Here, the black blobs will have a coefficient of minus one. So if you think about the wave functions, if you do the derivation, you can see that these cancel each other, the black with the whites in the position that you find it here. And it will be true, this relation, basically. And in general, you can do it for any J, and it works out with this correction to the n-fold symmetry. There is a second method, and for the second method, instead of the computational states associated with the set operator, let's consider the x-logical operator. So for in this case, let's consider only the plus state. So that would be for k equals zero. Is the plus is the eigenstate of x that gives you eigenvalue plus one. So let's consider that. So we put here k equal to zero, and immediately we kind of recognize, if we would go to the previous equation that we had before, that if we eliminate this, this looks very similar to a zero logical state. Because if you remember, we had some minus one to j times l, in that case would be, but for zero, that minus one is one in all cases, and we will have some rotations here. So we can identify this plus state of a dimension d2 and n-fold symmetry with a state, a zero logical state of dimension d1 with the n-fold symmetry related in this way with the second symmetry. So this is another way of encoding. Again, is identifying the wave functions of this and this and seeing that they are the same with the way we have defined the states. This is a summary. So of the different encodings and different conditions, I will not stop here, but just stress that the second method works for any dimension, whereas in the GKP and RSB first method, there is, your second dimension is kind of selected by A, where A is a natural number. And differently to discrete variables with rotationally symmetric codes, you need to have an extra condition here for the symmetries to do the encoding correctly. But then once we have identified the qubits or qudits of dimension d1 as in a higher logical space, so we have done this encoding of qubits into qudits, we have extended the set of logical gates in continuous variables. And then we can identify the families of circuits as Clifford circuits. And once we do that, we can borrow the theorems of discrete variables to apply them to continuous variables and say these structures, continuous variable structures are simulable. So what will change? For the GKP, it only changes on the displacements. So if you compare the GKP, these all are Clifford operations of a qubit. You compare it to the Clifford operations of a qudit. The only thing that changes, because we use the symmetric encoding, so the Fourier would be the same, the S-gate would be the same. Well, it would be the same if we are dealing with a qubit. Otherwise, here it will change in case we would have an odd dimension. But here, since we're encoding a qubit, we will always jump to a dimension that is even. So it will be the same. And the control state remains the same. So we have enlarged really just the x and the z. The x here, we go to a smaller and smaller displacements. And the same for the set here, plus what we already had before. And for RSV codes, more things change. So in particular, it changes also in the in these rotations. So we will go to smaller and smaller rotations when we go to a qubit that previously we couldn't assess because they were not logical operations for the qubit. And the same for this self-care interaction. This, in principle, this D can be very small, very large. So this coefficient would be very small. And we would access, therefore, more self-care interactions. And the same for the cross-care interaction here with this D. You can go to higher Ds because we had this relation between the second dimension with a natural number that we could choose arbitrarily large. So we have gain operations, and we are always comparing n qubits to n qubits. So indeed, we gain operations. Now we are in a better position to understand the results. So basically, the trivial example would be encoded Pauli eigenstates of dimension D1, Clifford or dimension D1, and homodyne measurements. What we have done, since we interpret these input states as logical states of dimension D2 that are stabilizer states, we can enlarge this set of operations here. And in the GKP, it is enlarged in these displacements, which are given by this. It's not a continuous parameter, it's a discrete parameter, but can be made arbitrarily small or very small. And the same for RSV codes. So the trivial case would be here having the Clifford for dimension D1, but we have enlarged this set of operations to Cliffords of dimension D2, and that enlarges the, as I said, the self-care interaction and the cross-care interaction. And the same for the other encoding, where we encoded only the zero logical state in plus states. And this is just repeating what I said before. These are the families of circuits that previously couldn't be assessed, but now we have identified as Clifford. So we borrow discrete variable theorems. So to summarize, the Wigner negativity is necessary, but is not sufficient for quantum advantage. We saw a trivial counterexample already. We can identify as Clifford circuits Wigner negative continuous variable architectures. For that, we have review and derive QDIT operations, review for GKP, because they were already in the literature, derive the QDIT operations for RSV codes, though maybe they are in the literature, but we derive it with the notation that we followed from the paper where they define the qubits. Then we have found the identification of qubit logical states as QDIT logical states by comparing the wave functions. So it's nothing really very fancy. And that led us to conclude that there are discrete families of continuous variable architectures with large Wigner negativity that can be efficiently simulated. Here I would like to point that maybe it's a bit misleading to say large Wigner negativity because we are with an ideal case. So maybe it's a bit unfair if the negativity is unbounded, but it's a way to contrast it with the classical algorithm by Pasayan et al., where the running time scaled exponentially with the Wigner negativity. So here, what we are saying is like, even if the Wigner negativity is high for these circuits, since we identify them as Clifford, we could borrow theorems from discrete variables and conclude that they are simulable. So even if the Wigner negativity is high, in principle, they cannot give any advantage. And limitations. The limitations is that we haven't really answered the question that we had because we wanted to have to assess this for general Gaussian operations. So Yeah, these operations here are the generators of Gaussian operations, and they have three continuous parameters, and we never have a continuous parameter. So the question, what happens when you have input Dgt states and general Gaussian circuits and then Pauli measurements, is still open? We are working on that right now. And then it was not really easy to get results for realistic cases with finite energy. And the reason was that the normalization constants in front of every summand of the wave functions change. Whereas in this case of ideal RSB codes and GKP codes, we could really identify the wave functions easily. So yeah, those are the caveats and limitations of this work. And yeah, let me finalize now by thanking again Cameron, Julia, and Alessandro for the really nice work. And you all for your attention, of course.
Great, thank you very much, Laura, for that really interesting talk. So do we have any questions?
Hi, Laura, I have a question. Thank you for a great talk, that was very interesting. So I wanted to ask, you know, Wigner functions can be viewed as a kind of special case of positive probabilistic representations. And so I guess negativity and positivity is often dependent on the basis you're considering or using. So like if you're using the Wigner function basis, something might be negative, but you might hope that if you change basis, things would become positive. So I was wondering, could your work be kind of rephrased in terms of, could one think that maybe you guys have found a change in basis that results in these negative representations becoming positive? Could I view it that way, or is there some technical obstruction to viewing it that way?
Yeah, I think you are totally correct. And actually, after publishing the paper, someone else already told me that this way of changing the basis could be interpreted in that way. Yeah. So possibly, yes, you are correct.
And do you know if that change in basis relates at all to like PQ functions, or is that a completely different thing, completely different form?
I'm not sure. I don't think so, because when we assess these circuits, I need to go back. There is, not only the Mariaiser theorem, but there is a paper by Rasimi, Kehari, and et al., where they have some conditions that are not only based on the Wigner negativity, but there is a combination of different quasi-probabilities. And even for that, we have some negativity for those conditions. So not only for the Mariaiser paper, we had negativity with the Wigner function defined as I defined it in the beginning, but also for those conditions. And those had the P and Q, they have some S minus S, in the conditions. I don't know if you know the paper that I'm talking about, but for that paper, this circuit in principle, when we assess it, it was not recognized by that. So I don't think it's so easy as P and Q, but maybe, I don't know.
Great, thank you for that.
Okay, do you have any further questions? I actually had a couple. So my main question is about simulating GKP qubits and simulating noise. So from the kind of my understanding of it is that you can simulate kind of these classical noise channels where you have these displacements, but you know, going beyond that, if you want, so I'm thinking if you want to simulate, let's say a GKP surface code or something, so you've got a lot of GKPs and it's not feasible to do it by simulating the wave functions. Is your work kind of, does it open up more possibilities of simulating different noise channels, or maybe, or would like the extension you talked about at the end, would that be something that would open that up?
I think that for considering noise, you need to go to the realistic case, right? Because what would mm-hmm. be the noise to a delta function, right? Like maybe you can consider displacements, yeah, but yeah, maybe if you interpret the noise as just a pure displacement on ideal GKPs, maybe yes, you can simulate that. Because this is exactly what we have, no? Some displacements mm-hmm. that we enlarge. But to be honest, I don't know how useful it would be since we already are dealing with a really ideal case of a train of deltas. So I really think that one would need to assess the case of finite energy. And in my experience working later with this, it's going to be easier to keep the GKP ideal and then try to assess more Gaussian operations here before going to the finite case, because it might give you some advantage. There is this paper, a last author, Nick Menicucci, where they have some gadgets where you have a zero logical GKP state, mm-hmm. a vacuum state, and then some displacements and control set operation and some measurement. And with that setup, they could distill magic GKP states. So it seems that when you go to the finite energy case and more realistic cases, you can distill some magic states. So I don't think that these results are going to hold. You are including the advantage somehow by adding the...
Oh, okay. And that thing you're talking about with the Menicucci gadget wouldn't be possible with the infinite energy case. You have somehow having the approximate GKP states means you can distill the magic states. Is that what you're saying?
They add I think it could be considered as the same thing, like mm-hmm. their gadget and adding some noise to this. I think it would be really similar, yeah. But I would need to think a bit more about it. But that's my intuition now. So this is just an hypothesis, right?
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Do we have any further questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Laura again for a really great talk.